Okay, Senate State Affairs is called to order. The time is 9:07, and the date is March the 4th. And we do have a quorum to conduct business consisting of Senator Bundy, Green, French, and myself, McGuire. We have four items on the agenda today. First, we are going to take up Senate Bill 265 by myself on sex offender compliance registration. Second, we're going to go to Senate Bill 276. We already heard the bill last week by Senator Bundy. Take that back up again, state construction project labor agreements. Then we're going to go to House Bill number 259 by Representative Anna Faircloth, establishing Alaska History Week. And then finally, Senate Bill 296, Crime Victim Compensation Fund. So without further ado, Trevor, I'm going to present Senate Bill 265. And he'll take questions, and then we'll go to, there are about five people from different departments. Is it properly before us? It was a CS adopted in transportation.
Okay,
so Trevor.
Madam Chair, thank you. For the record, my name is Trevor Fulton, and I'm staff for Senator Lisa McGuire. Thank you for the opportunity to present on the behalf of Senate Bill 265. Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to present once again. The state sex offender registry is a popular and effective tool that gives Alaskans the means to identify convicted sex offenders who may be living in their communities. The permanent fund dividend is home to perhaps the most accurate and complete database in the state. Senate Bill 265 combines the resources of the Division of the Permanent Fund Dividend and the Department of Public Safety's Sex Offender Registry in order to get out-of-compliance sex offenders to register. By withholding PFDs from sex offenders that are out of compliance with the state sex offender registry, Senate Bill 265 aims to bring in the 1 out of 10 convicted sex offenders who fail to maintain their registry information. By creating an incentive for convicted sex offenders to keep their sex offender registry information up to date, Senate Bill 265 would also relieve law enforcement of the burden of having to dedicate the time, the money, and the resources to track down non-compliers. Most importantly, Senate Bill 265 gives Alaskans an improved means to identify convicted sex offenders who may be living in their communities. Thank you for consideration of Senate Bill 265, and I would be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Senator Green?
I move that we adopt the CS version E as our working document.
Okay, is there an objection to that motion? Okay, seeing and hearing none, we have E before us. Senator Bundy.
I'm looking at, looking at Tam Cook's memo, and as I recall, felons are not eligible for PFDs anyway. Now, if someone who's a convicted sex offender but having served their term, are they then eligible for a PFD?
Through the chair, Senator Bundy, I'd be happy to address that question. If we can backtrack just one step there, I believe the version we want to be working off of is actually the version that came out of transportation, and that's version M. Yeah. Unless there was a mix-up in the packet.
Okay, let's take a brief at ease. Here in Senate State Affairs, Senator French.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would move that we adopt CS for Senate Bill number 265, Transportation /M, as our working document.
Okay, so we have that before us, and just before we went off the record, Senator Bundy had just asked a question, and I think there are two individuals that are going to be testifying that can respond. Debbie Richter is here with the Division of Permanent Fund Dividend. She can respond in her testimony and remarks, and Kathy Monfrida with the Sex Offender Registry. Kathy will tell you, as she did in transportation, that just a cursory examination of those out of compliance revealed roughly two-thirds that would have applied for and qualified for the dividend. So some of the folks on the registry would have. Do you want to respond? Anything, Trevor?
I think you said it as well as I could have, Senator. Thank you.
Are there further questions for Trevor at this time? Okay. So let's go to Kathy Monfreda.
Yes, ma'am, I'm here.
Good morning. Can we hear you? A little louder, please.
I'm talking as loud as I can. I apologize, but I just got into New Orleans from flying all night, and I can't adjust the volume on the phone.
Oh, my apologies. We've got you turned up now, Kathy. Thank you.
Okay. The question, is there a question before me?
Senator Bundy, do you want to rephrase your question for her?
Well, perhaps my question is better directed to the permanent fund dividend people.
Okay. Debbie, you want to come up?
Hi. For the record, my name is Debbie Richter, and I'm the director with the Permanent Fund Dividend Division. Could you please restate the question? I think I understand it.
Yeah, Madam Chair, if I might. I'm just referring to the memo we got from Tam Cook that lays out what I thought was the case, that a convicted felon is not eligible for a permanent fund dividend in any case. And so then my question is, does that prohibition go away after they've served their time and been released? And in this case, as a sex offender, would be required to register.
Through the chair, Senator Bundy, the sex offender would only be denied a dividend while the year that they were incarcerated. And if they're not incarcerated after that, then they're out in the public. They will be paid dividends.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Okay. Further questions? Okay. Kathy, why don't you go ahead, you can just stand by, Debbie. Kathy, do you want to go ahead and offer testimony on the bill and answer questions?
Oh, sure, Madam Chair. The only information I have to provide is public safety does support this. We feel that it's another opportunity to try to gain improved compliance of out-of-compliant sex offenders. And as the chairman stated earlier, in a quick review of non-compliant sex offenders last week, two-thirds of them had, in fact, applied for a permanent fund dividend check in the year 2007.
Senator Bundy.
Thank you. And then a question for Debbie again, if I might. As you review your records and cross-check them with Department of Corrections, you find a non-compliant sex offender who hasn't registered, you not only don't give them a dividend, but then you then notify whoever, Department of Corrections, or whoever should be notified that you've got someone who is in violation of the law.
Through the chair, Senator Bundy, at this time, we do not address the sex offender registry at all through PFD. We make a match with the Department of Corrections for incarcerated individuals for misdemeanors or felons, and that's the extent of the match we do now.
I guess I asked the question inartfully. Should this bill pass, would you then make the match, deny the dividend, and then turn them into Department of Correction?
Through the chair, Senator Bundy, no, we would not deny the dividend. The way this bill is written, we would withhold payment of the dividend for a period of 1 year to allow the sex offender to become compliant. At the point where they would become compliant, we would then pay them their dividend if they qualified in every other way.
Okay. Senator
Bundy. The second part of the question, would you notify Department of Corrections that they were non-compliant?
Through the chair, I believe that the Department of, I don't believe so. The Department of Corrections actually wouldn't be involved. It would be the Department of Public Safety.
Sex offender registry.
Right. And the evidence that the sex offender had become compliant would be coming from the Department of Public Safety, a match that we do with them. The way this bill is written, there would be eligibility work that would need to be done because the sex offender would need to prove to us that they were compliant. I'm not sure how we would communicate back and forth with them where we were in that process with each sex offender.
And through the chair, if I could just real
brief. I'm not understanding the process.
Well, the process will be established. The point of the bill is to bring sex offenders into compliance at this point in time when they apply for their dividend. Right now, a process that's pretty well oiled works for those who are convicted criminals already. And so what we've been doing, Senator Bundy, is working with Kathy Monfreda and working with Debbie Richter to try and come up with a process. But as you know, in statute, we tend to not dictate every little minute detail of how the agencies will interact. What we're going to do is set up a system that says that you have to do it to check the compliance. And we're going to leave it to the good people that do their job to come up with a system.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If I might, I think I answered my own question through the discussion in that the Department of Public Safety will already know who's not compliant because no one's registered with them, so there's no reason for you to communicate back with them. They simply have to communicate with you to let you know people are in compliance. So,
right, and then withhold payment of the dividend.
I was a little slow this morning. I apologize.
Okay. Senator French.
No need to mention that that's not an unusual.
Just
no, no follow-up on that point, Madam Chair, but on a different point.
Senator French.
Actually, it's related. I would assume that should the dividend be delayed and should the sex offender who isn't registered at the right address or hasn't registered separately convicted during that year, during the period of delay, then the dividend would be denied.
Through the chair, yes, that is correct.
And I think actually the bill is kind of a nicely nuanced approach to the problem. I'm no friend of sex offenders, but many of these failures to register are highly technical. Sometimes they're a matter of being a day behind, or you know, or having listed. You know, it can be a paperwork problem, and so it seems fair to hold back on the dividend for the time, see if the prosecutor's got a strong case and goes and convicts the person of failure to register, then the dividend's withheld. If it turns out that in the course of you know the legal proceedings, the case is dropped. And the sex offender is registered at the right address, which is really the idea
yes.
that you want to support is the policies, knowing where the individual lives so the public can be aware. Then you've gotten compliance, you've delayed the dividend, and then all is well. So I think it's a good bill.
Well, and our concern too, Senator French, you thought through exactly the process we did, was to go ahead and withhold it outright, take it away, permanently deny it, if you will, then creates a whole nother set of appeal processes and rights that arise as a result of that. And then if you were to later discover that it were a paperwork problem or there was a legitimate, attempt to register that didn't work out, then you've got an administrative nightmare. So what we're hoping we do is get people's attention. They register and they get the dividend and off we go. Okay, Senator Green.
Yeah, could you talk to me about the fiscal note, please? Thank you.
I could. Through the chair. This fiscal note, as I have kind of gone over in the analysis, does not address just this, the impact of this bill on the permanent fund dividend division. Mm-hmm. This bill, were it to pass, would affect every functional area of the division minimally. Okay, the situation in the division now is that we are backlogged in appeals. We have approximately 4,000 of them that we're not able to process. We're about 8 months behind. Mm-hmm. We are also, our eligibility staff would be, they're also our public response staff. So we're not able now to deal with the volume of contact that we get during application season and during payment season mm-hmm. with the staff we have. In order to impact this division all the way across, I'm asking for two positions. Mm-hmm. I'm asking for an eligibility specialist. Mm-hmm. They take a year to train fully, and they are, like I said, they're our public response, and they're also our eligibility staff. The contractual portion of this fiscal note for $96,000 is the cost of hiring the contractor to write the agency interface that PFD basically lost when we switched to our new database system. Our new database system is going to prove to be very efficient over time, but there are pieces of it that are not written that would work with other agencies, and I think all of the departments in the state are aware of this problem right now. This $96,000 writes that interface, and it makes the match that we're going to be doing with DPS possible.
Senator Green.
Is that $96,000 going to be incurred regardless of whether or not this bill passes, or is it only if this bill passes?
Through the chair, Senator Green, we have received the bid. We do not have the funding to implement it right now. All of the departments are being forced to work with our old government extract.
Thank you. Regardless is the answer, yeah. Senator Bundy.
Well, again, we're not in finance committee, but it seems as if that should have been a budget request and not a fiscal note on a particular bill.
Through the chair, we were not aware that this was going to be an unintended consequence of rolling our system over, and when we became aware of it, it was after the budget process.
And one more Senator question, Bundy. Mike. As a funding source, are you funded out of the earnings of the permanent fund like the corporation is?
We are funded out of the money that is transferred to the to pay the dividends.
Yeah, earnings. So it's earnings.
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Further questions?
Should increase point is fiscal note.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Debbie. Okay, Kathy, did you have anything else that you wanted to add so we can let you go since you've been traveling?
No, I think that pretty much covers it. I think, as you stated earlier, we'll work out the details with permanent fund. I know that permanent fund has some concerns about getting inundated with phone calls from sex offenders, and we are certainly willing to do whatever we can to discourage that as much as possible. We're used to talking to them. So and we'll post that on the website and any communications we have with them to try to limit the impact on PFD as much as possible.
That would be great. And would you be willing just briefly to put on the record the numbers that you've offered in the last committee about the percentage of people out of compliance in Alaska right now?
Yes, ma'am. Right now, there's, as a general rule, there's between 89 and 90% of the people are compliant, so between 10 and 11% of the sex offenders are out of compliance. And we are constantly trying to find ways to reduce that number and make sure people are in compliance. In some cases, these are people that may have left the state, and it's just a matter of tracking them down and finding where they went. We don't think that all of them are in Alaska, but it's an investigative process to try to figure out where an offender has moved to and then let that state know so that they can get them in compliance in that state.
Okay, thank you very much. I hope you get some rest.
Thank you very much.
Okay, Chris Ashenbrenner.
Thank you. For the record, I'm Chris Ashenbrenner, and I'm the executive director. Sorry, this is buzzing me. Executive director of the Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. And I will be very brief. We support this bill. We think it adds yet another tool to a very important tool chest, which is to keep track of sex offenders. So for safety purposes and accountability purposes as well. So I appreciate you sponsoring this bill, and I appreciate getting passed along and seeing this made into law. It's a great tool.
Any questions for Chris? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, next up, David Shade. David, were you just online to answer questions?
Yes, we were just online in case Kathy didn't make it to answer questions.
Okay, from the Department of Public Safety. Okay, Jerry Burnett? Okay, and Peggy Brown? No? Okay, so is there anyone else here in the audience that wishes to testify on Senate Bill 265? Anyone online that I've overlooked? Okay, so hearing and seeing none, it brings the bill back before us for committee discussion. Is there a discussion?
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Bundy?
I have to confess that when they concerned about, the concern was mentioned that PFD people inundated with phone calls from sex offenders, there would be a lot of heavy breathing going on.
We need the cameras to come back. We're way too casual without them. Senator French.
Madam Chair, maybe I could make a motion.
Yes.
CS for Senate Bill Number 265, Transportation, be passed out of this committee with individual recommendations and the attached fiscal note.
Okay, is there an objection to that motion? Okay, hearing and seeing none, 265 has moved. That brings us to Senate Bill 276. Senator Bundy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Senator Bundy, Senate District E. Does anyone have had any doubts? You have an amendment that is being distributed. This is an attempt to address a concern registered by Senator French last time we discussed this bill, and a legitimate concern that we want to make sure that people have accurate information when they're called on to make a decision that could be one that could be a very expensive decision should they make the wrong one. So with that, Madam Chair, or Mr. Chair.
You're out of order. Again.
I would like to move what I'd call amendment number one that's before us for discussion.
Thank you. Amendment number one has been moved. Is there any objection?
I'll object for the purposes of discussion.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Senator Bundy?
Yeah, and as I had said previously, this would require that an employee under a project work agreement is given information within the first 7 days of employment that would detail the various plans. In this case, it would be the union benefit plan and the non-union employer benefit plan, so they can make an informed decision.
Thank you. Further questions, Senator French?
No. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You remove your objection?
I do remove it.
Thank you. Objection has been removed. Any further objections? Amendment number one has been approved then. So before us, a bill as amended.
And I think we've discussed it, if I might, Mr. Chair, to some extent last meeting. It is a, as I said, somewhat tongue-in-cheek pro-choice bill in that giving people who go to work under a project labor agreement an opportunity to be vested in the union benefit plan, if indeed it looks as if that is the most beneficial to them personally, or to, which is most often the case, to continue with the benefit plan of their employer. As was discussed under the Trans-Alaska Pipeline situation, people went to work and they were not employed long enough to vest. Now, there has been a change. In those days, it was a 10-year vesting period. Now it's a 5-year. But even so, in many construction jobs, I think we find that 5 years, even with the pipeline or gas pipeline when it occurs, is quite a long time. So it may be indeed someone's best interest to continue with a program that is the non-union one, or if at some point they feel that they'll be involved in the union project for an extended period of time, they could elect that option.
Thank you, Senator Bundy. Further questions, comments? Chair would entertain a motion to move.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, I would move Senate Bill 276 as amended from committee with individual recommendation.
Thank you. Is there any objection to that? So moved. We'll move on to House Bill 259, Establishing Alaska History Week. Representative Faircloth, thank you for being here.
Good morning.
Good morning.
First, thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee members, for hearing an act to establish the first week of every March as Alaska History Week. This bill was brought to me, or this idea was brought to me, by those who participate in a national history program that runs throughout our nation. In 1999, Alaska first began to participate. In 1991, Alaska had its first championship or a contestant in the nationals. And in 2007, we had 31 students make it to nationals. In 2008, we expect participants of over 40. What happens at National History Day is they choose a topic, and I thought it was rather appropriate for this year for us to be discussing this. The national topic is conflict and compromise for 2008. And so students across our nation are challenged with talking about, either through a documentary, paper, or projects, or even developing websites, about conflict and compromise in specific spots in history and in time. And so what this bill would do would align us so that our students could compete nationally and also to honor the different things that have happened to make Alaska the great state that it is by designating the first week of March as Alaska History Week. I'm trying to remember. There was just a few brief things. The earthquake happened to us in March, not the earthquake, but in March. Alaska was bought and brought into our great nation in March. The Iditarod runs in March. And so our bodies jointly together just established Susan Butcher Day as the first week in March. And instead of having individuals honored on an individual basis, it was my thought and why I agreed to bring this bill forward that we should have a history week period so that we can recognize all the great accomplishments of our state and do it in a focused period of time. It doesn't cost the state any money. It doesn't mandate our schools to do anything different, but it does create an avenue for them to participate nationally with other colleagues. With that, Madam Chair, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Great. Senator Stevens.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Well, as a former history professor, I fully approve of what you're doing, but I do object to the first sentence of your sponsor statement. While relatively short compared to other states around the nation, history of Alaska is one. We have a longer history than most states around the nation. Native Alaska came, actually, those people who came to this continent came through Alaska thousands upon thousands of years ago. So can you change that to say the, you know, maybe short European history, but a long history nonetheless?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
That's a great answer. Representative,
well, yes.
If we can't amend the bill, we'd amend the sponsor statement
that's
here
right.
in the Senate.
That's right.
Representative Faircloth, can you tell me, you might have already touched on this, and my apologies if you did. Do schools currently teach Alaska history?
In the Anchorage School District, they do. I know that it was a curriculum that was adopted several years ago, so I think it depends on each region. I don't think it's mandated Alaska history from the state curriculum, but I know that in the municipality of Anchorage, we do have that.
Okay, I was just going to say that in my time in the Anchorage School District, we did have it, and I have benefited from it greatly. I remember scoffing at the notion. My apologies, Senator Stevens. I wasn't an early history buff, but I really benefited from it, you know, having that basic background of, you know, how we became a state and what the history is and so forth, the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, all those kinds of things.
Madam Chair, if I might respond, I totally agree, and I do think it's been a long history. When you can have land connecting one continent to the other and traversing across to reach the Alaska and we just have such a rich heritage that should be honored, and it's just another way that kids can get involved, youth can participate at different levels, teachers can teach to it when we have a point in time that actually is the bellwether, particularly for a particular moment in time.
Wish we could mandate it in Alaska history in California school systems, as an example. Senator Bundy.
Would you like to entertain a moment?
Yes.
And I should know this, and perhaps Professor Stevens knows, but certainly when I went to school in Washington State at college level, one of the college requirements was to take a state history class. Do you know if that exists in Alaska at all? And
sir, I was in college some time ago. I was required U.S. history and world history, but I don't think Alaska history was a part of my accreditation. Yeah.
Well, no.
A project for us.
Okay, any that brings the bill back before us. Is there anyone here in the audience wishing to testify on House Bill number 259? Is there anyone online? Okay, hearing and seeing none, that closes public testimony and brings House Bill 259 back before the committee. Is there a motion? Senator Stevens.
Madam Chair, I move that we move House Bill 259 out of committee with attached zero fiscal note and individual recommendations.
Okay, is there an objection to that motion? Okay, hearing and seeing none, the bill has carried. Let's take a brief at ease.
Back to order, please. We have Trevor back with us, and Jared Godfrey, are you still with us? Yeah. He is? Okay. All right. Trevor. Thank you. Glad you're with us, Jared. Trevor, would you identify yourself and introduce this?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Trevor Fulton. I'm staff for Senator Lisa McGuire, and I thank you for yet another opportunity to present before the committee. Senate Bill 296 creates a non-general fund program for the Violent Crimes Compensation Board, and by doing so generates additional funds for the board with no additional outlay of state funds. Members of the committee, the arguments for and against putting these sorts of dedicated funds into statute are familiar territory for all of you. In fact, if we put into statute a non-general fund definition for the VCCB, or Violent Crimes Compensation Board, it would be the 83rd such fund on the books. But while some may be philosophically opposed to putting these sorts of funds into statute, it's difficult to argue that the state is better off foregoing the additional 60 cents in federal grants that would be generated for every dollar put into the Violent Crimes Compensation Fund. The VCCB's mission is to help mitigate the financial hardships innocent victims can suffer as a direct result of violent crime. The board may compensate medical expenses, counseling costs, lost income, lost support, funeral expenses, and or other reasonable costs sustained by Alaskan victims of violent crimes. Senate Bill 296 would generate additional funds for this important program without any additional appropriations. I hope you will join the sponsor in supporting this idea, and I thank you for listening and for the opportunity to present Senate Bill 296.
Thank you, Trevor. Any questions of Trevor?
Yes, Mr. Chair. It's being changed to say that the consists of money appropriated to it by the legislature, which may include donations, recoveries of or reimbursements for awards made from the fund, income from the fund, and other program receipts from activities under this chapter. And where's the connection of the source of the money that's coming in? Somehow I'm missing it. Maybe I read this too quickly.
Senator Green?
Yes.
Yeah, Senator, response, Trevor?
Through the chair. Can you clarify the question a little bit?
Yeah,
I'm not sure.
I'm trying to figure out, in the sponsor statement, it said, had the board been able to receive these funds into their budget, the board would have recovered an additional 65 cents on every dollar. Which funds is that talking about?
That's federal money. No, I think I understand the question. At least I question along the same lines. Maybe I can.
Okay, go ahead.
About it. The
do you have this in your package?
The sponsor statement in the first paragraph says that you award, say, $1.3 million every year. That's been the average annual over the last 4 years. Okay, that's in paragraph one. In paragraph three, it says if you could get these funds that you're taking in to pay out into the budget, you would have gotten an extra 60 cents on every dollar from federal grants. And then it says, the last sentence in that sponsor statement says, without any effort, the VCCB would have gained almost $1 million in 10 years. So my question is along the lines of Senator Green's. You must not be talking about all the money you received, because if you're giving out $1 million a year, and you're going to get 60 cents on every dollar if you just get that money into a special fund, then you should be talking about $600,000 a year. There's some kind of disconnect in the amount of money you're going to get from the feds, the amount of money you're taking in. And maybe you can explain that, or maybe someone else can.
And Trevor, if you can explain that, or we can go to Mr. Godfrey.
Mr. Chairman, I would like to take a stab at it, but forego any confusion. I think maybe we should refer this one to Mr. Godfrey online.
Okay. Thank you. Well, let's see. First, Jared, Senator Stevens here. The chairwoman has stepped out of the room, is involved in some other bills, so we will not be moving this bill today, but we will be hearing it. And if you'd identify yourself, Mr. Godfrey, for the record.
Yes, Jared Godfrey, chairman of the Alaska Violent Crimes Compensation Board. And I'm not certain I understand the question. However, if you give me, 2 minutes, I will try to, give some background here. And then if the question is not effectively answered, I'll take the question again.
Okay, Jared, that sounds good. Go ahead, please.
Okay. Basically, what the Violent Crimes Compensation Board does, I believe you guys are all familiar with, when anyone comes to the board with a claim, they sign a subrogation agreement. And I'll give you an example. The maximum allowable for any victim that the board can compensate would be $40,000. And that's entirely compensatory. It has to be tangible losses, okay? So it can be a combination of medical expenses, counseling expenses, funeral expenses, lost wages, relocation. And so let's say hypothetically, and this is hypothetical, but it happens, so it's historical too. Somebody comes to us and they were a victim of DWI. We know that they're going to win a lawsuit insurance settlement. However, as anyone knows, insurance companies are not quick to settle on this until, a certain amount of protracted time goes by. However, this person is out of work. They're losing their wages as we speak. Their bills are compiling right now. The board can help them now, and they're not going to have a settlement for 13, 15 months. Let's say the board gives them $35,000 compensable losses. $35,000 comes to them. We know that through the subrogation agreement, when they get their settlement, their attorney's going to come back to us and say, here's that $35,000 back. What we did is essentially give them a de facto loan because the board operates as a payer of last resort. So we're giving them that $35,000. A year later, let's say, they come back and say, hey, I got that settlement for $100,000, here's a $35,000 back. We have no means to accept that. Obviously, we have no receipt authority. So that same $35,000 that operated as a loan that got them by while they were waiting for a suit to be adjudicated in their favor could then easily compensate 8 other victims for their losses. But instead, it goes into the general fund. The 60 cents to a dollar we're talking about, that is available regardless whatever the state puts up. We are funded primarily and historically through the garnished PFDs of felons. Correction gets the biggest slice of that pie. We do the second biggest, and OVR slice is getting bigger, and then it's divvied up, a few other advocacy groups, that account for the entire funding from those garnished PFDs. A few years ago, when we were facing a decrement during Murkowski's administration, we were funded through the general fund. We're looking at $400,000 decrement because the PFD average had gone down so much. However that money gets put up for the Violent Crimes Compensation Board, it's eligible for 60 cents to the dollar federal matching funds, and there is no cap on that federal money. The way that we're trying to explain it is, if that money was reallocated to us, the money that we brought in, for example, we handed out in our annual reports when we were in Juneau back in January, some graphs to illustrate the amount of money in the last 10 years that we brought in through the subrogation agreements, court-ordered restitution, penalties, et cetera, assessed by the courts. And in the last 10 years, in the graph, it would illustrate in the neighborhood of $500,000. And that's without us doing anything. And that's money that originated from the board's initial funding and most of that money originated from the garnished PFD money, and then when it comes back to us, we don't get it. It goes to the general fund. But if that money was put back into our fund, it would be eligible yet again for the 60 cents to a dollar federal money. And that is how, you know, we're looking at it. Ultimately, if the board was given the money back that it was initially given, that it recuperates, in the next era of decrements, the board believes that the board could sustain itself while the corrections and OVR and the other agencies get a larger piece of the pie. If we're giving back the money we keep bringing back in, ultimately we could, you know, sustain ourselves. Our budget has fluctuated between, you know, $1.7 million to below $1 million, and that just depends on the garnished PFDs. Did that clarify it for you?
Well, thank you, Jared. It's I think it did, but I'm not sure I can explain it to somebody. Senator Green, did you want to follow up, and then we'll
I don't know. I would suggest a review of the language in the section one under the added additional language, and because I found it very confusing. Everyone else may understand it, but I found it very confusing. And is it improper to, I'll ask Senator French, is it improper to use the word such as subrogation or court-ordered restitution?
My view is the clearer the better. I mean, I just don't see
that. Yeah, I mean, I don't want to restrict it by adding extra words, but did you understand what this was?
No, we get to the point.
Yeah.
I ask questions, Sarah.
You're on the witness stand. No.
I'm a little fuzzy still about the details. I mean, it's not entirely clear to me why some dollars count for the 60-cent federal addition and why some don't.
If I could try to clarify that. I don't have the committee is reading in front of them, in front of me, so I'm kind of going off of what you guys are trying to understand without the benefit of looking at it myself. All the money the state puts up, and whatever the state puts up, whatever the source, whether it's the garnished PFDs or the general fund itself, is eligible for the 60 cents to the dollar. I guess the way that we see it is that money that was eligible 60 cents to a dollar that we put up this year, this fiscal year, the money that comes back to us again that ultimately didn't get expended because through subrogation agreement or recuperation through restitution orders, then would be eligible to 60 cents to a dollar yet again, that same money, rather than a different allocation of money. You see what I'm saying? So if $30,000, this is hypothetically $30,000, was put up this year, and therefore it's eligible for 60 cents to the dollar federal money. And it was utilized in the form of that illustration I gave you, like the DWI victim, that $30,000, and it comes back to us again. Next year, that same $30,000 is yet again eligible for 60 cents to a dollar. Rather than using new money, we're using the same money to get that 60 cents to a dollar again.
Thank you, Jared. Senator Bundy had a question for you.
The example I was going to use is just recycles the money. Mm-hmm. I had this visual picture of a bucket with a hose from the bottom going around coming back to the top, and we just keep recycling this money in it. And basically, it's almost an arbitrage thing. You're getting federal money for the same money over and over again. Seems like
a percentage of it, you know.
Barely legal, but...
but do you object to that?
No.
Thank you.
No.
But now the problem is all of that money that comes back in from subrogation goes into the general fund and never gets back into your account. Therefore, you cannot present that to the federal government and get your 60 cents on the dollar. Is that correct?
No. Well, the same money. I mean, when it goes into a pot and it comes back, you know, this is fuzzy, obviously, but it will, whatever the next year the state puts up, whether from the general fund, garnished criminal PFD, or the money that the fund retained, it's still going to be eligible for 60 cents a dollar. I've been really reluctant to use this term, but I'm going to go ahead and use it now. We're double dipping that same money.
Thank you for saying that.
Yeah.
And the same federal money. The federal money is available regardless of how the state puts it up. And so that $30,000 can be utilized again after it operates as a de facto loan, or we recuperate it through restitution order. It can operate again for that same 60 cents a dollar that it already received.
Jared, Senator Green.
It appears to me what this bill intends to do is just cut out a step. The $30,000 comes back, goes to the general fund, we appropriate it, and they get the 60 cents on the dollar. It's the same money. But we may not appropriate that money. And so
This
seems, well, I'm share everyone's caution about dedicated funds. It seems that if this is money that they generated, perhaps it ought to go right back to them rather than go through the budgetary process. And as Jared pointed out, times are lean, they may not get back the $30,000 that they generate.
Exactly.
And this would put it directly back to them with and just save a draw on the general fund.
Thank you.
And if I may add, the point being is the money that was allocated by legislature that comes back to us never actually served its purpose, because it wasn't expended. It was recuperated. It was expended in the short term, but then we recuperated it. Yet it should still be available to serve its purpose. And we have had the board for a couple of years impose policy limitations on how much we would award certain categories, and we had to restrict ourselves on awards dramatically, because we could either help the first 30% of claimants in a fiscal year that came to us 100% with what they were entitled to, or help all of them in the year, you know, at 55% of what they were entitled to. And this would, you know, hopefully allow us in the future, when we look at decrements, not to have to do that.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, follow up, Senator Bundy.
Yeah, if I might, and I think I understand this, and I just want clarification. Instead of dealing with $30,000, I want to deal with the dollar. Someone's convicted, they lose their PFD. That dollar of that PFD that goes into the victim's compensation fund then gets used to compensate some victim. That victim repays that dollar, and under the current system, it ends up in the general fund. So actually, this program could generate money that goes to the general fund that they are really responsible for generating, and if this bill passes, that dollar doesn't go into the general fund, it goes directly back to them, and it's money they generated anyway.
Well said.
So if I can follow that up, what you're saying is we get a dollar, you get a dollar into the fund from the state, you get 60 cents matched by the feds, that's $1.60. You loan it out, you get it back, the $1.60, you get another 90 cents, so you parlayed that into what, $2.50 or something. yeah, I think I understand it. Okay.
I won't challenge your math, but you definitely have the concept.
Okay. Thank you, Jared. And I'm sorry, we have Senator French and then Senator Green.
I'm just thinking that if the bill works the way it says it works, and I'm a big supporter, I like the idea. I mean, BCCB is a something I have near and dear to my heart. We may want to get a revised fiscal note. It sounds like we would be spending less general funds on satisfying these claims, and we would be using some federal money to actually do that. It may help us to hear from Mr. Swanson or Mr. Brooks. I don't want to steal the work of the federal of the Finance Committee, but they're awfully busy, and so we may be able to help them by doing a little work down here. And
okay, which fiscal note are you referring to?
Looking at the one that is dated 2/29/08, signed by Eric Swanson and Kevin Brooks on SB 296.
Thank you, Senator French. Senator Green.
Jared, are there occasions when you do not get repaid for either a loan or a payment to a victim?
I'll be very candid with you, Senator. We with limited resources, our staff is three people in Juneau, the administrator and two staff persons under the administrator. We do not have a whole lot of motivation, the board itself is all volunteers, to pursue those people that, that, you know, everyone had to sign a subrogation agreement. Those people that ultimately are going to win a lawsuit and the perpetrator, you know, is solvent, perhaps the perpetrator worked on the slope and, you know, has some cash in the bank or what have you. We do not expend the resources to go after that because we can't recuperate it. So it just doesn't serve our purpose to spend our limited resources to pursue somebody who we know, you know, can give us back that $25,000 when we're not going to recuperate it. You know, and I don't want to sound, legalistic or sympathetic to the fact that they owe the money. I'm being realistic and saying it is not time well spent by the board to pursue money owed to us. So, you know, an attorney, when they retain an attorney, which, you know, typically they will, especially if it's not an insurance settlement, when a claimant retains an attorney, of course, by, you know, they are obliged legally to disclose that to us. And what they will do is they will petition us. I would say 90% of the time, their attorney will petition the board to ask forgiveness on the subrogation, and they will give us a pretty strong or the best compelling argument they have as to why, you know, their client did get a settlement. Here was the amount of dollars. However, their client is far from whole. They'll walk with a limp in them, for the rest of their life. They're going to need to get job training again because they were a carpenter by trade and they no longer can physically do it and things like that. And I'll be honest, the board wants an attorney to give us a good pitch, and we pretty much take it at the first blush and then make our determination, because to spend, again, the resources to vet out the veracity of what the attorney's saying. I mean, he has an obligation. He's advocating for his client. He's going to make the best argument. Sometimes we buy it, sometimes we don't. Perhaps if we knew we could recuperate it, we would spend a little more time and ask for more documentation and some follow-up from the attorney. But yes, you know, answer you the long route as I did, yes, there's times when we do not recuperate money that was due us.
Okay, so it would be difficult then for you to really approximate what you could have if you had been at 100% trying to get to subrogate and to get payment from people, the perpetrators, your income might have been coming back, would have been much greater. But do you think your attitude would change if this bill went through?
It would change, because I want to go back to what Senator French said a minute ago, that in fact it's very true that this board could become much more self-sufficient by recuperating that money and sustain itself more so than and lean on the general fund in the future less and less, to the point maybe not at all, because we then would have motivation to go after this, and yes, our attitude would change. We would then require, we probably would require and develop a policy series of steps whereby if an attorney comes to us and says, you know, hey, we would like forgiveness for our client's subrogation, and here's why, we may have a series of steps they're going to have to go through for us to even consider that. Yes, our attitude would change, but it's purely amount of it's purely based on economy of motion and efficiency, and limited resources. You know, we would like to go after the money whether it's going to the general fund or not. We just don't have the resources to expend at that.
Okay. Well, would you object to some kind of phrase going into this legislation that you would pursue?
I would not object at all. In fact, that is totally consistent with this board's position and stance, and I have no problem with that in the wording at all.
Thank you.
In fact, you know, hey, if we're compelled to do it, that's all the better.
Great. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Green. Any further comments? The intention is to set this aside, deal with it next week, but clearly we've touched on some important issues that need to be clarified. Trevor, it seems to me that we need to work on that sponsor statement somewhat to make it understandable.
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
We need to, you still feel we need to revise the fiscal note?
I would just like to at least hear from the folks that prepared it to get their take on how the money flows. I think we've gotten, you know, sort of through the collaborative process, a pretty good idea, but it'd be nice to hear from someone who oversees the, you know, the flow of funds through the compensation fund.
And then we need to also pursue Senator Green's idea of encouraging you.
A mandate.
Due diligence.
Okay, so Trevor, you have all that and ready to get to work, and next week we'll deal with it. Thank you very much, Jared, for being here. Any concluding comments you have?
Other than the fact I'm very appreciative, the board's very appreciative of the fact that the judiciary on the Senate, on the House side, and State Affairs has taken this on for us. This is something that the board has been something of a crescendo, I would say, that the board's been building up to for a number of years, and we're really hoping to make it happen this session. And it's very gratifying to see it, you know, finally on the cusp of reality. So I appreciate the questions and the request for clarity, and I appreciate the opportunity to give that clarity. Thank you.
Thank you, Jared, and keep up the good work. So we know where we're going with this, and with that, we are adjourned.
Thank you.